Let me start as usual by asking you what questions you have on what we did last week on the economics of risk and on ex post ex ante enforcement. Any questions on those subjects? All right, then the next question is let me do a very quick review of the ex post ex ante, where the basic idea is that you can prevent problems or create outcomes either by controlling inputs or outputs. In the employment context, that's the difference between paying for hours and paying for cars sold, say. And in the criminal or the legal context, it's the difference between punishing behavior that on average leads to some undesirable outcome and punishing the outcome only when it occurs. The advantage to controlling the input, the advantage of controlling the output is that first it's easier to measure. You can see that an accident happened and did a certain amount of damage. It's harder to estimate ex ante what the average damage from some behavior is. In addition, by punishing the output, you give the actor an incentive to use his private information. If I know I'm doing something likely to cause an accident, even if the police don't, I've got an incentive not to do it if I know that an accident will result in bad things happening to me. That might be a disadvantage if my private information is wrong, but in many cases, individuals know more about what they're doing than outsiders do. The main advantage to monitoring input is that you can use small punishments much of the time instead of large punishments very rarely, and large punishments get you into problems with the punishment cost. And you can think of punishment cost in the one case is if it's a monetary punishment, punishment cost is coming from risk aversion, the fact that the individual whose behavior is being controlled would rather pay $100 once a year than $100,000 once a year with one chance in 1,000, because he's risk averse, but also because many people don't have $100,000. If you, as you scale up the size of the punishment, you tend to shift from fines, which are a relatively efficient punishment because somebody else gets what you pay, to things such as imprisonment, execution, flogging in some societies, various forms of punishment where the cost to the offender is not balanced by a direct benefit to someone else's. And that's the point we're going to come back to, because especially when we're talking about criminal law, one of the interesting issues is what combination of probability and punishment you use to punish some offense. If you could spend more money on police and prosecutors, you could catch a larger fraction of offenders. You then wouldn't have to punish them as severely in order to deter the crime. So what are the trade-offs? And one of the trade-offs is that high punishments are often costly. In practice, we often use both ex post and ex ante, that if you are in an auto accident, there will be some undesirable consequences to you, although some of them are covered by insurance, and if you drive faster than the speed limit, you might get a ticket. And indeed, the arguments we've offered suggest that you would probably never use pure ex ante, because ex ante plus an ex post, which is not large enough to raise punishment cost problems, would be superior. And they also suggest that if the ex post would not be large, if you imagine you're deterring some behavior that only does modest amounts of damage, that then it would make sense to have a pure ex post system, because again, the problem with ex post won't arise there. And one final point is the linkage between the question of ex post ex ante and the question of punishment for attempts. That, as I suggested, the fact that we punish unsuccessful attempts raises two puzzles. One of them is why punish them at all, since they did no damage, and the other is why punish them less than successful attempts, since if you're thinking of punishment as giving people what they morally deserve, it would seem as though trying to kill someone is the offense, and whether you succeed or not is more or less accidental. And I discussed a little bit of the moral puzzle, which I find interesting. If you want more of that, you can find an article on my webpage, which I think is Payne versus Tennessee, if I remember correctly, was the name of the case, which in which I discuss it at greater length. I think one of the reasons I did that was that when I first submitted the article to a journal, it was rejected because it was too short, which strikes me as saying bad things about law reviews, but in any case, that seemed like an interesting thing to add to it. That then gets into the question. The answer from the law and econ standpoint is that you can think of the punishment for an attempt as an ex ante punishment supplementing an ex post punishment for success. So that if you imagine that you would like a $10,000 punishment for something, if people don't have $10,000, we say, all right, $5,000 for trying to do it, another $5,000 for succeeding, or in other words, $5,000 for attempting, $10,000 for succeeding. Actually, that means that's more than $10,000. It's $10,000 plus an extra for the attempt that failed. I didn't put that quite correctly. And finally, it gets into the question that I found sort of intriguing a long time ago about impossible attempts, and that's my voodoo murderer, which is a nice, memorable way of looking at it. And there, the argument is that if you say that attempts that can't succeed aren't punished, then people who don't know whether they are using a method that works, whether voodoo works or not, will reasonably enough say, if it turns out it doesn't work, I won't kill him, but I also won't get punished. If it does work, I'll kill him and I might get caught and punished. Whereas if you say impossible attempts are punished too, then even if it doesn't work because it's impossible, I still suffer some penalty. And there's the somewhat subtle distinction between a rule which says voodoo attempts aren't punished and a rule that says impossible attempts aren't punished. Because if the people knew that voodoo attempts weren't punished, that would have no undesirable consequences, because it would only encourage them to use voodoo, which doesn't kill people. At least I assume it doesn't kill people for purposes of my argument. I'm a skeptic on the subject of voodoo. Any questions on that? And that then sort of morphs into the point that there's a certain sense in which all unsuccessful attempts are impossible, looked at after the fact, because you can't kill somebody by shooting the tree next to him. All right. If people are satisfied with that stuff, let's go on to game theory, which is a subject one could probably spend a whole semester on, but we're going to spend a day on it. And let me again start by asking whether there are things that struck you reading the chapter that you had questions about and would like explained. No. Yes, good.
I mean, I guess you might go over this, but the entire thing of game theory, do you always look at it like a bilateral monopoly?
No, that's only one particular game. That there are games which have more than two players. There are fixed sum games, which bilateral monopoly isn't. No, bilateral monopoly is one game that shows up in lots of contexts, but it's only one of many games. That, in a sense, you can think of, I guess, of three different, at least two different ways you could approach game theory. And one of them is by looking at games, and one of them is by looking at solution concepts. In what sense something does or doesn't solve a game. And if you had a really wonderful, powerful, beautiful solution concept, it would solve all games. And you could then say, well, this game we solve this way. We don't. And therefore, there's some tendency to divide it up into, well, this is a game for which this solution concept tells us something useful. This is the game for which that solution concept tells us something useful. And I'm giving a very fragmentary account of game theory in this chapter, and so it sort of is largely divided into particular games. Let me go back a step. The basic problem is strategic behavior. The basic problem is, if you're dealing only with an unthinking world, then you've got a sort of a simple maximization problem that, you know, how do I minimize the time from here to home? How do I maximize the chance that the medical treatment will save this patient's life? You can think of a whole lot of problems where there isn't a player on the other side. All right, where all you, I mean, some of them may be very hard problems, but they're not conceptually hard. You can say, well, here are the odds that this medicine will produce this effect.
here is what I know about how fast traffic is on that street at this time of day, and so forth. Introduce at least one other person, and you have a whole different class of problems, because now, if I do this, he will do that. What's he trying to do? He will threaten. He will say, well, I don't want you to do that, so if you do that, I'll do this, it'll make you worse off. You have a whole bunch of problems that don't exist in the context where there are no other people involved in the conflict. And one of the useful distinctions here is between zero-sum, sometimes called fixed-sum games. I'm just looking for the marker. Thank you. And non-zero-sum game. So, zero-sum game is a game where anything that benefits one player harms the other. Or you could have more than two players, but take the two-player case. So, if you and I are playing chess, and the only reason we're playing chess is that we have a $100 bet on who wins, that's a zero-sum game. If I make a move that makes it more likely I win, makes it less likely you win, helps me by a certain amount, hurts you by a certain amount. Now, even chess, realistically, is not a zero-sum game because people play it apart for the fun of it. So you might say that this particular opening would have given me a slightly higher chance of winning, but it leads to a really boring kind of game. Whereas this unconventional opening, yeah, I might lose, but we'll really have fun trying to develop what to do after that. So in that sense, even chess wouldn't be a zero-sum game if we allow for the fun as well as the money. But if you think of something as a pure zero-sum game, it turns out if you think about it, that that's inherently simpler than a non-fixed-sum game, because it eliminates some of the strategic behavior. In particular, there is no reason for threats or bluffs in a zero-sum game. Why? Because what's a threat is something where I say, if you do this, I'll do that, even though I don't really want to do that. I'll do that because it hurts you, even though I otherwise be better off doing something else. Does that make sense? Right? If I say, if you do this, I'll do that, because it's the best thing for me, well, it might hurt you, but that's not, I'm not doing it as a threat anymore. All right? But a zero-sum game, anything that hurts you helps me. There is no such distinction. Hence, that particular sort of strategic behavior you would think of in terms of threats and bluffs disappears in that context. All right? For zero-sum games, two-party zero-sum games are the closest thing to something we've got a solution for. Go back a step. What would it mean to solve a game? Suppose we describe some game, and the book has a number of games, Prisoner's Dilemma, Bilateral Monopoly, whatever else I have in there. Let me give you a few other games just to make the point of, I've listed a few games, not all of which are in the chapter, but can be explained briefly. Games. Bilateral Monopoly is a game. Can somebody define bilateral monopoly as a game, not as economics? What makes us describe a game as bilateral monopoly? What are the special features of that game? Two people, a buyer and seller. Well, the fact that they call them a buyer or seller is just a particular situation. What's the logical structure of the game?
Whatever it goes for money. It's like a transaction for it.
You can imagine a lot of things that don't look like the stories I tell that you think about but still feel like bilateral monopoly. So,
yep. The situation where the thing somebody wants is they have a person that same person.
Well, that's something that will give you a bilateral monopoly, but again, you sort of think of the game as being described in the chapter. What's essential about it? Suppose you've got two roommates, your husband and wife, and the dishes have to be washed, and neither of them likes dishwashing, and for a moment think of it disliking dishwashing equally well. But leaving the dishes unwashed, you're going to end up with the cockroaches in the house.
Can you see that the argument about who washes the dishes sort of looks like a bilateral monopoly, even though nothing's being bought, sold, transferred? So what's the essential? It's a very simple bilateral monopoly because there are only two prices, but what's going on in all of these stories? Is bilateral monopoly a fixed-sum game? Is it a zero-sum game?
It's not.
Good. Why is it not?
Because, well, if I take the dishes, cockroaches, for example, I mean, if one person does the dishes, they may not like washing the dishes, but they eliminate the cockroaches. So there is some benefit to it.
Putting it differently, there are typically two outcomes. One is success, in which there is some benefit, and the other is failure, in which that benefit doesn't occur. So in the cockroach's case, success is the dishes get washed. Failure is they don't. Failure is worse than success from the standpoint of both parties. In the case where I'm selling you an apple, success is I sell you an apple at some price. Failure is the apple doesn't get sold at all. And I eat the apple even though it's worth less to me than to you. So what's the common characteristic of all of these? What are we trying to get? What's the one essential thing in order to get success in all of these games?
You're getting more out of it than the other person.
No! More than the other person? Success? The apple is worth nothing to me and a dollar to you. If I sell it to you for 20 cents, we both succeeded.
Okay.
We've got the dollar game. If I sell it to you for 80 cents, we both succeeded. We've got the dollar game. We just differ in how it's gotten divided. In order to get that dollar gain, what's the one thing we've got to achieve?
We have to agree on it.
We have to agree. Exactly. So the bilateral monopoly is a game where there is a benefit if the two parties can agree. You lose that benefit if they don't agree. And what they're agreeing on is the division of the benefit. Does that make sense? So in the very simple dishwashing case, as I was saying, there are really only two prices there. Either I wash the dishes or you wash it, so there are only two divisions we're considering. But since both of us are better off, I'm better off if I wash the dishes than if nobody does, because I dislike dishwashing less than I dislike cockroaches. You're better off if you wash the dishes than if nobody does. So either arrangement, we are dividing the game. It's just that if you wash the dishes, I'm getting most of the game, and if I wash the dishes, you're getting most of the game. So essentially, bilateral monopoly is a non-fixed sum game where there's a benefit that can be gotten or a cost avoided, which is the same thing, if the two parties can agree on the terms of division. Right. And that could apply to sale, it could apply to lots of other cases. Right. So that's bilateral monopoly. Prisoner's dilemma. Thinking not of the particular story that I tell, which is sort of the standard story that gives it its name, what's the essential feature of that game?
Yep. The best solution for each person makes them both worse off.
Yes. That is that each person is making a choice which is the right choice for him, whatever the other one does. That's sort of a fairly strong result. And both of them making those choices gives a worse result than both of them made a different choice. That's right. And I think of that as sort of the prototype for the fact that individual rationality doesn't always mean group rationality. Often does, but often doesn't. So that's a game. Let's see. Try to what other games. Let me give you a game which I don't think is in the chapter, but perhaps should be. Three-person majority vote. The standard version of that is there are three of us, we have a dollar, and we decide by majority vote how the dollar will be divided among us. So he and I could vote that each of us gets 50 cents and you get nothing. You and I could vote that each of us gets 50 cents and he gets nothing. You and he could vote that you get 60 cents and he gets 40 cents and I get nothing. All of those are possible. All right? It provides a very simple example of a more than two-person game, and it's interesting probably for that purpose. And one of the interesting features, if you think about it, is that at least in the simple sense, there doesn't seem to be a solution. Because suppose he and I agree to split the dollar 50-50 and cut you out. You can then go to him and say, look, I got a better deal for you. You get 60 cents, I get 40 cents, and we cut him out. That dominates, in that both of you are better off under that deal, and the two of you are enough to vote. At which point, I go to you, and I say, look, I got even better deal. How about 50-50 between you and me? That dominates the previous one. I'm getting 50 instead of 0, you're getting 50 instead of 40, and the two of us can make. So you can imagine sort of the bargaining going around and around forever with no outcome. And all right, so those are a few games, and there are lots of other games that we could look at and take those for a moment. What would it mean to have a solution to a game? Suppose somebody says, aha, I have solved bilateral monopoly. And you say, well, all right, then tell me, what would you be asking to tell you? What's a reasonable request for what someone who says he's got a solution to a game might be able to do? What do you think? And then maybe we have one answer.
You know, what the solution would be?
What does it mean to have, not what is the solution, what does it mean to have a solution? What are you asking him to tell you when he says he's got a solution? Let's take the easiest of these three, which is bilateral monopoly. What is it, in what sense can we say we have a solution to bilateral monopoly? The solution isn't watching what they're doing. It's you as the theorist saying something about what they're doing. Right?
Would it be being able to predict what they would do?
That would be the nice thing about bilateral monopoly. And about the prisoner's dilemma is that's the one of the three where it's a clear sense you can't. So one possible solution concept would be predicting what people would do. That's probably too demanding, because suppose that it turns out that one of the two doesn't speak English, and therefore can't understand the offer made by the DA, and therefore you don't get your prediction. Somehow that doesn't seem like it keeps yours from being the right solution. So one sense of solution is what will happen if what? What are you going to assume about the players in order to get, in order to make your prediction come true? So one plausible definition of a solution is what will happen if each player acts rationally in his own interest. And in that sense of the game we've discussed, Prisoner's Dilemma is the only one that we actually have a solution to. And that particular solution concept is what's sometimes called dominance. That's certainly used for other things as well, but meaning that there is a choice for me which is the best choice whatever you do. And therefore the usual problem of I'm trying to decide what you're going to do here and so forth disappears. In particular cases, the first one would have to be to imagine something where the dominant solution was an attractive one. But the basic solution concept here is a case where my choice doesn't depend on yours, where whatever you do, a certain thing is right for me, whatever I do, a certain thing is right for you, and therefore we can say if we're both rational, we'll do those two things. Right? So that's one possible solution concept. Unfortunately, as I say, it sort of breaks down because that doesn't exist for most games. Von Neumann, who more or less invented the field, had a much less transparent solution concept. And this was for the specific case of two-player fixed sum games. And what Von Neumann's solution was a pair of strategies. Something player one does, the strategy player one follows, the strategy player two follows. Where there is some value to the game for player one. And if he follows his strategy, he is sure to get at least that much on average. There may be random elements as well, so there may be some dialogue. But if we think about the average outcome, so for a let's try here. Solution concepts, dominance, PD, Prisoner's Dilemma. Von Neumann solution shows that any two-player fixed sum game, there is some value to the game, which is the amount that player one can guarantee himself on it to get on average. Guaranteeing meaning whatever the other player does, but on average, averaged over whatever the random factors in the game are. If player one gets V, what must player two get, given that it's a zero-sum game? Really? Is V plus nothing equal to zero? If it's a zero-sum game, player one gets V, what does player two get? What?
It's not V.
V is an amount. What is the sum which added to V gives zero?
Right.
Of course, V might be negative. There's nothing the theory tells you. They might both be zero. Nothing the theory tells you whether one player has an advantage. But that there is some value to the game, such that player one, if he plays a strategy, can guarantee that he gets at least that value. And player two, if he plays his strategy, can guarantee that player one gets at most V. So player two can hold his losses down to minus V. And player one can force his losses to minus V, as it were, and his gains to V. All right? Sometimes referred to as a mini-max or a saddle point. There are various terms for this, but that's the basic idea of the money-making strategy. All right? Makes sense so far. Von Neumann proved that any two-player fixed sum game, there was such a pair of strategies. That's probably the most unambiguously solid accomplishment in 80 years of game theory, 70 or 80 years of game theory. Let me give you an example of a game that probably most of you are familiar with, which is a two-player fixed sum game that at first glance doesn't have a von Neumann solution, and show you how you deal with it. The game is Paper, Scissors, Stone. Does everybody know Paper, Scissors, Stone? Yes? No? You look puzzled. It may not be. The way it's a game played by children. And the basic logic of the game is the two people simultaneously put out a symbol with their hands. This is scissors, this is paper, this is stone. That scissors cut paper. So if I put out scissors and he puts out paper, I win. Stone breaks scissors. So if I put out scissors and he puts out stone, he wins. Paper covers stone. So if he puts out paper and I put out stone, he wins. Make sense? Imagine that you play the game for a stake of a dollar each time. That the loser pays a dollar to the winner. All right? And it looks as though there can't possibly be a von Neumann solution. Because whatever I am playing, there is something you could be playing as a result and you're beating me. Does that make sense? However, von Neumann's solutions are strategies, and strategies allow the player himself to randomize. So how would I play scissors, paper, stone in such a way that I know that on average I will never lose money? Clear? Not clear? What? Sure. What strategy on how to play could I follow, which I know on average won't lose me money? You can follow it too, so you on average can't make me money. It's a symmetric game.
Do you have to play?
Yes, I have to play. Not planning is a different solution, but not the one we're discussing. It's not clear.
Throw the same thing.
If you throw out the same thing, you're going to lose, because the other guy will rapidly discover what you're throwing out and will throw out the one that beats you. Take a die. Somewhere where the other player can't see you, you roll the die. One through two is paper. One or two is paper. Three or four is scissors. Five or six is stone. All right? There is no strategy he can play which, on average, will win more than a third. Right? You win a third, lose a third, tie a third. He can do the same thing. So that is a von Neumann solution to the game. I guarantee that I get at least zero. You guarantee that you lose no more than zero. And it's one that depends on a mixed strategy, and in fact, in order for his proof to work, you have to include mixed strategies among the options. Mixed strategy is a strategy with some probabilistic mix of doing different things. All right? Let me describe to you something that's not, I think, in the chapter, but maybe should be if I ever revise the book, and that's yet another solution concept, which is called subgame perfect equilibrium. Which is actually got
fairly popular a while ago among law and econ people. I'm not quite sure why, but it does have the virtue that it gives you a clear answer, though it's not clear if it's a correct answer, and it only applies to certain kinds of games. But imagine a two-player game, this in this case need not be fixed sum, which consists of consecutive choices by the players. So player one does something. He can do, let's say, either of two things, might be more than two. Whichever he does, player two then has a choice. And he can do, let's say, three things here or two things here. Then player one has a choice. Whatever happens. All right, and you can imagine that going on for some sequence. At the end of it, there's a payoff. At the end of it, at the end of each of these things, player one gets some amount, call it, what, P for payoff, and player two gets some amount, I'll call that P2, but that's an orange P because it's the other player. So if you make this choice, then this choice, then this choice, you end up here, and this guy gets $5, and this guy loses $3, say. All right, does that make sense as a way you could describe such a game? And you can see that there are quite a lot of, not all games, but quite a lot of games that you could imagine in that form as a series of things. Subgame perfect equilibrium is a very simple idea, and that is that we look at the last choice that player one makes. The last choice that the last person to play makes, whatever the sequence is. So in this case, player one. Player one says, or player two could say, anybody could say, if I get to here, I can choose between this outcome and this outcome. Which is better for me? Which one has the larger payoff? If this one, suppose this payoff for me is 10 and this is 5. Well, if I get this far, obviously, what am I going to do? So we can cut that off and ignore that. That no longer matters. Run through all of these and do the same thing. Each case, you look at which alternative gives the higher payoff, cut off whichever one gives the lower payoff. There's a better something else, too. Now, do this all the way. Now we can say, all right, that means that getting to here results in my getting a payoff of 10 and results in his getting, let's suppose this was minus 6, whatever. In his getting minus 6. So I can erase this last row of things and say it's just like a game where after this choice he gets minus 6 here, whatever the equivalent is here and here, and these seem to get these payoffs. All right? We've just eliminated the last layer by simply saying we know when the last choice is made, people will choose whatever gives them the highest return. All right? But now we can do the same thing again. We say here, let us suppose the numbers were minus 6, minus 2, 0. By doing the same thing, when this guy gets here, he says, all right, I'd rather have 0 than minus 2 or minus 6. So he cuts off those branches. And we now know that if we get this far, he's going to get minus 2. And let's suppose that that minus 2 went along with a plus 3 here, so that 3 is there. Oh, sorry. That 3 is there, but this is the one I put the minus 2 in the wrong place. My fault. Well, make this minus. Doesn't matter. But if it was good, he was going to go up this way, not down that way. So it's this one where it's minus 2 here, and say 3 there, so we now move that to here, move this down to here, and now we do the same thing here. Now this guy's got a very simple choice. He knows that if he makes this choice, this guy will choose this, he will then choose this, so all he does is to pick whichever of those has the higher payoffs. Does that logic that make sense? Yes? No? Anybody?
I guess, are we assuming that he wouldn't choose the 10?
I'm sorry. Where was the...
The 10th on the...
Ah, no, but he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. The point is, I'm assuming it's set up so that this choice, this gives him a worse return than one of the others. Mm-hmm. So therefore, once it gets here, he's not going to go down this line, so therefore he doesn't get to choose the 10. Mm-hmm. Right? If it did get here, he would choose the 10.
Okay.
All right? Yeah. But it's never going to. They're alternating who gets the choice. Each time the person makes the choice that's best for him. When you first look at it, you say, but wait a minute, we don't know which choice is best for him because what happens depends on the rest of what happens, but that's all right. Start at the other end and just work backwards. All right? Make sense? Doesn't make sense? All right. So that's subgame perfect equilibrium, and that has the virtue that for that kind of a game, it gives you a nice unambiguous answer. Can you see why it might be the wrong answer? Why the underlying is, there are underlying assumptions in that way of analyzing the game might always not always apply. Let's consider a game which I discussed briefly in the chapter, though I don't discuss subgame perfect equilibrium as the way of understanding it, and that's what I think of as the tantrum game. And it's the game, do any of you have children? No, it's a game, you have children. So you may have already played this game, and if not, the rest of you at some point probably will. And the form of the game is that you're having a dinner party, and your 3-year-old or 4-year-old or 5-year-old or 6-year-old really likes staying up late at your dinner parties and eating some of the nibbles that are passed around and getting smiled at by all the adult guests who say what a cute kid this is and so forth and so on. So on the other hand, you know that if you let your kids stay up for the dinner party, somewhere around 10 o'clock that kid is going to crash, going to be bad-tempered, not going to get enough sleep, going to be a real pain the next morning. All right? This is a common problem. So two alternatives for you are let the kids stay up or put to bed because it's your bedtime. The next choice, however, is made by the kid. And one possibility is tantrum, and the other is behave. And as it happens, those two choices are available, whichever thing you do, although the child has no reason to choose tantrum if you let her stay out, because that's what she wants. And what are the payoffs? Well, if you put the kid to bed and she shows a tantrum, you're not going to let her come down again. You're going to keep her in the bed, lock the door or something, or just tell her she mayn't come out. Maybe you aren't going to give her a dessert tomorrow for dinner, though that's probably too distant a punishment to be useful. But in any case, you are going to try to make that an undesirable form of behavior. And the result is that put to bed and tantrum, her payoff is minus 10. But you don't like that either. I mean, you don't really like tantrums. Your payoff is minus 10, too. All right. Behave, on the other hand, that's minus 5, because she'd really rather go to the dinner party rather than being put to bed. But and yours is plus 5. Your friends will admire what a well-behaved child you've got. All right. On the other possibility, if you let her stay up, now she really has no reason to throw a tantrum, but she could. If she threw a tantrum, the result for her is, let us say, minus 8, whereas stay up and behave is plus 5. She likes, I'm assuming she's capable of doing that, and she likes staying up late at your dinner parties. On the other hand, for you, her tantrum is really bad, but that's not going to happen, so it doesn't really matter. And her staying up and behaving is mildly bad for you because you know that even on her best behavior by 10 o'clock, she's going to be pretty bad, and you know she's going to be a real pain the next morning due to not getting enough sleep. All right? So if we apply subgame perfect equilibrium, when we get to this point, what does she do? When we get to the point where you've insisted on putting her to bed and she has to decide where to throw a tantrum, what does she throw it or not throw it, according to subgame perfect equilibrium? What? If she throws it, what? She gets a payoff of minus 10. She behaves. That's what subgame perfect equilibrium tells us. Right? And this one, in this case, she'd behave here too. There's really no point in throwing a tantrum here. So therefore, staying up gives her a payoff of 5 and you a payoff of minus 5, whereas being put to bed gives her a payoff of minus 5 and you of plus 5. Notice that you're making the choice between these at this point. So which do you choose? Put her to bed. Does anybody believe this story? Right, you don't believe this story. Can you explain why you don't believe this story?
Wrong.
Your definition of rational is too restricted. Why don't you believe this story? Yeah.
Probably because they know if they throw the tantrum, they can get their way.
Well, in this story, they aren't going to get their way this time.
No.
But she, because she can see, she may not put it rationally, she or her genes can see, that if she could somehow guarantee this result, if she can somehow make it so you can throw a tantrum and put to bed, then you're going to say, well, minus 10 is worse than minus 5, and you'll let her stay up. So what we're now dealing with is a commitment strategy. We're dealing with the fact that if she can somehow tie her hands, as it were, if she can make sure that if you insist on putting her to bed, it's a wholly unreasonable thing for a daddy to do, that she will then lose her temper and throw a tantrum, then you realizing that will rationally make the choice she wants to make. And if you think about subcane perfect equilibrium in general, implicit in the analysis is that there are no commitment strategies. That if people have ways at the first step of making sure that if they get here, they'll do that, even though when they get here, it won't be in their interest to do that. The knowledge that when you get here, they'll do that makes the other person do different things, which gets you to a more desirable outcome. Does that logic make sense? Yes, no, you're looking puzzled. Do you see why, if the little girl could commit herself, could somehow turn some switch in her head, such that if she's put to bed, she will throw a tantrum? Why is there anything to do that? Is that clear or not? No, I'm looking at him actually, any of you things. You have a puzzled expression in your face, that's why I'm pushing you. No? Alright, can you see why she would turn that switch in her head if she could?
Yeah. The outcome. If she can commit herself to throwing attention all the time, it's always going to lead to her staying up, because her father is going to commit to taking negative 5 up with a negative 10. If he knows.
He doesn't have to commit to do it. That's what he does without committing. In fact, what the father would like to do is to commit first, always putting her to bed, and that wouldn't pay her to commit to
it. If she commits to the tantrum, you would know that she's going to play that gentleman. It's easier for her.
And you could certainly imagine cases outside of this particular story where what you're doing is you've got children dealing with each other in some sequence of events, and where one of the sides says to himself, if we got to there, I would do this, which he wants me to do. Can I find some way of making it very difficult to do that, by giving a speech saying that doing that is really stupid or something like that, and make it clear to him, and then he'll know that if he gets me to here, I'll do that, which he hates, therefore he'll make a difference with Jeremy on. All right? So basically, one problem with some game perfect equilibrium is that it assumes people can't commit. It assumes, as it were, that this game is the entire world, and that you don't have reasons to act in certain ways in this game in order to establish how you will act. Or don't have ways of... I mean, even if this was the whole world, if you could turn that switch in your head, it would still make sense to do it. Right? But a lot of turning the switch in the head really is knowing that you're playing other games in the future, and showing that you're a hard bargainer, or that you don't put up with being mistreated by your parents, or things like that, is going to be interesting.
This game only works if you know the outcome.
That is, subgame perfect equilibrium requires that for each final outcome, you know the payoffs. That's right. You know the payoffs, and you can then work back accordingly. So you can certainly see cases where it would be a very useful way of analyzing things, but it's by no means a complete. All right. So that's another one.
sub game. Perfect. And I guess it's being called that because you're thinking of each step of this as a sub game. If you get to here, you then have this very simple game. You know, the solution. So. Let me discuss another solution concept, which applies to a fair number of games, and one which I don't think I discussed in this chapter, but I discussed it elsewhere. And that's what's called Nash equilibrium. Nash equilibrium. There was a movie called Perfect Mind or something about Nash. Nash equilibrium is called Nash equilibrium because it was invented by a Frenchman named Carnot. This is in conformance with Stigler's law, which holds the scientific law of determining character they're really better. Now, I'm a little unfair because Carnot gave the idea for a much more limited case. Carnot really explained the idea of Nash equilibrium only for a two-person game, whereas Nash equilibrium is the generalization to an n-person game. But the basic idea of Nash equilibrium is you have a multiplayer game in which each player is choosing a strategy. And each player's strategy is best for him given the strategies chosen by all the other players. So he is, as it were, imagining if I change what I do, that won't change what they do. Each of them has got a strategy. Or it'll change what they do only in the way implied by their strategy. And given that, this is the best choice for me, and the one he's making is the best choice for him. So to take a sort of trivially simple example, consider which side of the road you're. Having everybody drive on the right side of the road is a Nash equilibrium. Because if I know that everybody else is driving on the right side of the road, the consequences to me of driving on the left side of the road are much worse than driving on the right side. But notice that having everyone drive on the left side is also a Nash equilibrium. So a Nash equilibrium is not in general unique. It might be unique, or there might be many different ones. Because mine is best given what all of them are doing, but if all of us change, then maybe a different thing is best for each of us. All right? Makes sense. Furthermore, not only is it not unique, there are a couple of other problems. One of the problems is that a Nash equilibrium assumes no coordinated behavior. It assumes each person thinks everybody else's behavior is given. And my standard example of why that matters is to imagine a bunch of convicts who are escaping from death row. They're all expected to get executed at some point in the next few years. And they make it to the gate of the prison, which for some odd reason is open. And there in the prison gateway is standing a guard with a gun with one bullet in it. And the guard says the first guy who crosses that line dies. What's the Nash equilibrium? Correct. None of them cross the line, because if nobody else is crossing the line, it's very difficult for me to cross the line. On the other hand, if two guys trust each other, one of them says, you ready? I'm ready to zip. One of them died, and everything else gets out. 50% chance of dying is better than a certainty of being executed is the assumption here. All right? So the Nash equilibrium is stable against independent action, but might be unstable against coordinated action. The same thing is true about what side of the road you're driving on. That if you think about it, given what the rest of the world is doing, think about it for a single country. If you're a country in Europe, both driving on the right side and driving on the left side are Nash equilibrium, but one of them is better than the other. Which is the better Nash equilibrium? Given the state of the world as it now is. Right side or left side? Because most of the world is driving on the right side. So if you're in Sweden and you drive on the left side and everybody else drives on the left side, you better stay on the left side because that's what they're doing. But the result is that when you go outside of Sweden to anywhere except England, everything is wrong. You're used to driving on the left side, everyone else is driving on the right side. Your car has got the steering wheel on the right, which means you can't see around people when you're driving on the right side of the road. Doesn't work very well. You don't have as many different cars available because some cars aren't going to be made with left-hand drivers. So, make sense? So what's the sensible thing for the Swedes to do in this case? What they did, in fact, do, I should say.
Push the person.
All at once. That's the critical thing. So they decide on a particular time, on a particular day, everyone is going to switch from from driving on the left side to the right side. They move all the traffic signs, I guess during the night before that, I don't remember the details of how they did it, and boom, dawn rises on everybody. So that's like my escaping convicts, except it required a much larger coordination. It required coordination of everybody instead of just doing it. All right? So the Nash equilibrium is, again, it's a useful concept. It'll help explain where you will be with some, for some games some of the time, but it is not in general unique, so it may not give you a single prediction, and it is maybe unstable against coordination depending on the particular game. There's one further and somewhat more subtle problem, and if you're curious about the details, if you go to the game theory chapter of my price theory text, which I've got links to the class webpage on the web, I discuss in detail. But if you think about, do you know what an oligopoly is?
Familiar with the term?
I'm sorry, what?
Oligopoly? What?
Is it more like a group of people controlling?
It's a industry which has more than one firm but not very many firms. So if you have, let us say, the U.S. auto industry, where there are a few firms, not, so it's not a monopoly, like a single firm, but it's a small number of firms. And in the standard analysis of a competitive market where there are lots and lots of firms, each firm can take the behavior of the others as given because it's small enough so that what it does doesn't affect them. But if there are only six firms, if my firm decides to cut prices, the others may respond. If my firm decides to increase output, which will probably require it to cut prices to sell more stuff, the other firms will respond. Suppose you want to use Nash equilibrium to analyze an oligopoly. Right? The critical question is, what is a strategy? Because when every firm is producing a certain number of units at a certain price, probably all the same price, and that's the number of total units they'll sell at that price. Suppose my firm decides to produce some more units. The other firms don't have the option of continuing to sell the same number of units at the same price as before, because the extra units I put on the market are going to either take customers away from them if they keep their price up, or force them to lower their price. Make sense? Suppose we define the strategy as a price. Suppose we say what we mean when we say that when I change what I do, they keep doing the same thing, is they keep charging the same price and they sell however many units they can sell at that price. All right? What's the Nash equilibrium? Imagine for simplicity that what we're producing costs each of us $5 per unit to produce. What's the equilibrium price? What's the only Nash equilibrium price on that game? Suppose everybody else is charging $10. What should I do? Given that I want to know what's the best thing, given they're not going to change their price if I change mine. $9.99, I would think, but yes, $9.99. Because I can sell lots more units that way. I'm selling everybody. I can sell the whole market. And I'm making $4 profit instead of $5 profit I'm making. If I cut to $9, what is a sensible thing for you to do? Because you're selling 0 at 10, right? If you cut to 8, what's a sensible thing for you to do? What's the point at which this process stops? At $5. So the equilibrium, the Nash equilibrium of the strategies of price is based on cost. It's called Bertrand competition in economics. Suppose, however, we assume that a strategy is not a price but a quantity. That each firm says, I produce a certain quantity. If he cuts his price, I'll just let the price fall until I can sell that quantity. It turns out the analysis is then much more complicated. It depends on details, but you don't, in general, compete down to price equal quantity. So that's a case in which the prediction of the same definition, namely Nash equilibrium, gives a different prediction according to what you assume people's, what the kind of strategy is. Given that the strategy has to include some response to what you do because you can't keep doing the same thing. So that's a somewhat subtler problem with the concept of Nash equilibrium, which I thought was worth pointing out. Let me think. I had a fair number of other things I was thinking of saying. Let me think about which ones are particularly interesting. Let me run through a little bit of the bilateral monopoly commitment strategy kind of logic.
And if you start out with the bilateral, simple bilateral monopoly, you can see the commitment strategies, just as in the game I discussed, are important, because if I can somehow take the case where it's an apple that's worth nothing to me and a dollar to you, if I could somehow commit myself not to accept any price below 90 cents, you'd pay 90 cents, right? Because 90 cents is better than not getting the apple that's worth a dollar. If you could somehow commit yourself first not to pay more than 10 cents, I'd accept 10 cents. All right? So that's sort of part of the logic of bilateral monopoly, is each side trying to commit itself, and if they fail to do so, they're haggling, and there's no particular basis for saying where they're going to end up. And there is some risk that if both of us bargain too strongly, the deal falls through and the apple rots, basically. All right? That's the logic of bilateral monopoly. Let me go on to a related case, which is the nuclear machine, which I discussed there. How many of you have seen Dr. Strangelove?
Huh, all right. Used to be a very well-known movie, but that was out of date. But I don't watch any movies anyway. But Dr. Strangelove, I didn't think very highly of it. I actually read the book the plot was stolen from, and I thought that the book was a better story than the plot, right? Because the movie is intended to be a sort of black comedy. What?
Gentlemen, you can't
That's right. The reason I thought the novel, that I liked the novel better, was that in the novel, the Air Force officer who's responsible for the attack is not a lunatic. He is a, in some sense, admirable man making a hard choice. That basically the context of the novel is that you have an Air Force officer who's in command of the largest strategic air command wing, a lot of bombers. He was in Eastern Europe when the Russian army came in at the end of World War II and saw all sorts of horrible things being done. So he has very strong feelings about the idea of being conquered by communists. And his professional estimate is that at this point, the U.S. can win a first strike. If the U.S. makes a surprise attack on the Soviet Union, they can take out enough of the Soviet Union's military so that although there will be some retaliation and some Americans will be killed, it will in some sense be a tolerable. But that the Soviets are gradually catching up with us, and therefore, if we wait much longer, we can't. So he arranges to make it look to his pilots as if the U.S. has been attacked, and as if they're being sent in retaliation. He, once they're off the ground, and there's no way of he's got whatever the code words necessary to reach them and recall them, he then informs the rest of the Air Force what he has done. And he says, look, you can't stop my boys. You might as well send in the rest of the Air Force and do a good job of it. And he then kills himself in order to make it impossible for anybody to force him to give the information. And to me, as a reader, the fact that he kills himself, in a sense, makes him a morally admirable person. Because he's doing a terrible thing, but he's willing to pay the cost himself as well as imposing the cost of, 100 million Russians to be killed, whatever the number is. Anyway, in the movie, he's a lunatic. And that's, I found that less satisfactory as a plot. But in any case, the guts of it in, I think, both, certainly in the movie, I think in both of them, is that the Russians have a doomsday machine. People understand what a doomsday machine is. And they have been postponing the announcement to celebrate the premier's birthday, and unfortunately the attack comes before that, so the world slams. It's the end of the movie, and I think the end of the novel, positive. Novel is called Red Alert, if you want to look for it. And I think that the people who did Dr. Strangelove did eventually make some damage payment to the people whose plot they had stolen. But in any case, the context in which I started thinking about this, partly other than having read about the doomsday machine a long time ago, was a talk when I was at UCLA, where somebody was arguing that you couldn't use, essentially, that rational models didn't work for understanding crime. And so the story he tells is two guys sit down in a bar and start discussing football teams. And they disagree on which team they're in favor of. And the argument gets more and more heated, and they're drinking a bit. And when it ends, one of them is lying dead on the floor, the other is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face. And the guy who was giving the talk said, now this can't possibly be rational behavior. He regrets it as soon as it happens, so you can't deter him. And I jump up, as I'm probably
making it a better story than what really happened, but I jump up at one end of the room, and Earl Thompson, who's the guy from whom I learned a good deal about commitment strategies, jumps up at the other. So, of course, it's rational behavior. It's a doomsday machine going off. And our model of what's going on is you're a big, tough guy, and you can train yourself into an aggressive personality, into being a bully. And what does being a bully mean? It means that when people cross you, you beat them up. And you can define crossing you pretty broadly. A guy who dates the girl you're dating, for example, is crossing you. A guy who is insufficiently deferential to your obviously expert opinions about football teams is crossing you. And why is this a profitable strategy for you? Because people can see that you behave this way and they therefore take care not to cross you. All right? It's a commitment strategy. Actually beating somebody up is costly. He might be big enough to fight back and you might get in jail or get hurt or something. But you don't have to beat people up as long as they all recognize your strategy and defer to it and therefore never challenge you. Alright? Make sense? Unfortunately, you're not the only person playing the strategy. And one day you sit down in a bar and there's another big tough guy and he is fool enough to think that the other football team is the best football team. And when it's over, one of you is lying dead on the floor and the other one is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face. That's our interpretation. This turns out to be the human version of a game that the evolutionary biologists have called hawk-dove. And the hawk-dove game, they're using the term hawk-dove in the political sense of pacifist versus warmonger. And the idea of the game is you have some species of bird, which has two subspecies that they differ in only in behavior. When two birds see the same piece of food and both head for it, a dove will bat off, and a hawk won't. A hawk will fight for the food. Now you ask, what's the equilibrium of this situation? If there are no hawks, the first hawk has a clear win, because he always gets the food, he never has to fight. If there are lots of hawks, doves win. Because if there are lots of hawks, it's true that when two birds see a bit of food, the hawk has a 50% chance of getting it, and a dove 0%. But the hawk has an almost certainty of getting into a fight because it's almost all hawks, and fights are expensive. You get hurt. Consequently, if you think through the logic, there's some equilibrium percentage of doves and hawks. That being the percentage at which the two strategies are equally attractive, at which the advantage of getting food when you encounter a dove just balances the disadvantage of getting in a fight if you encounter a hawk. The higher the damage from the fight, the lower the percentage of hawks in equilibrium. Well, let's go back to our bar rule for all. In principle, if you think of choosing strategies as rational, even if behavior, once you've chosen it, is not, then if there are very, very few bullies, it pays to be a bully. Number of bullies increases. As the number of bullies increases, the risk of running into another bully and getting hurt goes up. Equilibrium is reached when the two strategies are equally functional. Now, obviously, I'm oversimplifying a lot. Some people are better qualified to be bullies than others because they're bigger and tougher, etc. But leaving that aside, if they're all identical, you would then end up with some percentage of bullies, that being the percentage at which the gains to being a bully from people deferring to you just balance the cost of getting into fights. If that's right, then punishing crimes of passion, like my barn room brawl, will actually reduce them. Not because the person is deterred when the crime occurs, but because it makes the strategy of being a bully a more or less attractive strategy and fewer people will choose them. So that's sort of interesting. Yes, no people following? Alright. I'm not sure it's right, but I think it's at least a plausible line of argument. Let me take the next step, though, which also gets interesting. And that's, I've explained in a sense why people are bad people. Let me see if I can also explain why good people. Because we have this puzzle, to which there are a number of solutions, which I like to think of as the puzzle of why are there people who won't steal, even if they're sure nobody is watching. And you can think of that as psychology or morals, etc., but I prefer to think of it as economics. And so my argument goes as follows. Suppose your utility function, suppose the description of how you behave was written on your forehead. So when somebody was deciding whether to hire you or whether to work for you or whether to be your partner or whether to buy from you or whether to marry you, they knew whether you were or weren't the kind of person who would steal if nobody was watching. All right? you're hiring somebody, and you say to yourself, I've got these two people I could hire. Looking at his forehead, he's an honest guy who, even if I'm not watching, will never try to cheat me. He'll act reasonably in the common interest of me and the firm. He, on the other hand, is an opportunist. Looking at his forehead, I can see that if he could get away with things from me. How much more am I willing to pay? I could hire either of them, depending on the wages they charge. But how much more wage am I willing to pay him? I'm willing to pay him a higher wage, which is the sum of the cost of being stolen from if he steals me, and the cost of watching to make sure I'm not stolen. What is the benefit to him? What is the cost to him of being honest, and the benefit to him of being dishonest is the amount he can steal. But the amount he can steal has to be lower than the sum of the amount he can steal plus the cost of precautions. Hence, the wage premium to being honest has to be more than the cost of being honest. Hence, if everybody has its utility function written on his forehead, it pays to be honest. It pays to have written on your forehead, I'm a good, trustworthy guy. Alright, does that make sense? And the final step is my claim that people do have their utility function written on their forehead, even if not perfectly clearly. That each of us, all of the time, is giving a monologue of the inside of his head, in voice tones, face expressions, choice of words, gestures, and so forth. And most of us are pretty good at reading those monologues. In fact, if you know somebody moderately well, you have a reasonably good idea of what he'll do, what he values, what kind of person he is. It is possible to cheat on that. If you're clever enough, you can give all the signals from being an honest person when you're really a dishonest person. And the people who are really good at that we call con men. But it's a hard, it requires a lot of skill. Because in order to do that, you've got to be in your head two people at once. You've got to be figuring out in your head what you would be thinking and feeling and saying if you were the honest guy you're pretending to be, and at the same time watching for opportunities to cheat people. Hard. Very harder to run two presses than one. If that's right, then on the whole, it is profitable to be a good guy. Now, if everybody was a good guy, nobody would be paying attention, and therefore it would be profitable to cheat. So therefore, you would have an equilibrium where the most talented con men find their best strategy is to cheat, and everybody else finds their best strategy is to be honest. Final step in this argument, the reason it's related to the bully argument. The bully strategy only works for involuntary interactions. Taking the same argument, suppose you're applying for a job, and while you're applying for a job, you say to the boss, by the way, I think I should tell you that when people cross me, I beat them up. You too. You have not given him a good reason to hire you. All right. The virtuous strategy, being a good guy strategy, only works in voluntary interactions. If you're with somebody for a reason that doesn't involve his choosing to hire you, or some similar transaction where there's a price implied in it, now there's no reward to being a good guy. But being a not good guy, you get a chance to steal from me. So the bottom line of this argument is that the larger the fraction of interactions in a society that are voluntary ones, the more good guys are the fewer bullies. So it does actually have an interesting prediction about the nature of societies coming straight out of economics. All right? Make sense? Doesn't make sense. Anyway. It's what I call the economics of virtue and vice and virtue. Now, virtue has a very narrow definition here. What I mean by virtue is not doing what God wants. It means a policy of when you are in a voluntary interaction with people, acting to maximize the sum benefit for those people. That would be the full version of my not stealing when nobody's watching. All right. Let me say a little bit about what we can learn by the analysis we've done, which is a very, very partial, first because game theory is very far from a finished project, and second because it's only one chapter in one day instead of a book and a semester. We don't get very much in the way of rigorous answers because the real world doesn't come as boxes with rules on it, and because even if it did, it's hard to know what the answers are. But we do get, I think, some useful ideas that are relevant to being a lawyer or being a legislator or even designing a firm or something of that sort. One of them is that you try to stay out of prisoner dilemma games. So that if you're in a situation which has the potential for that, try to figure out how to change it so it won't. So that you if you're planning to engage in a crime with a partner and you anticipate the risk of ending up in that story, one of the things you'll do is to say, look, before we do this, each of us is going to take a bag with $1,000 in it, hand it to a guy we both trust, and tell him that either of us betrays the other, give all the money to one who betrayed. That would be an example of changing the payoffs in the game by the way you set it up to stay out of the prisoner's life. The other side of that, though, is that you want to put your opponents in prisoner's lives. So that, in my view, if you really understood military history right, you would discover that a lot of what made successful generals was keep getting their army out of large-scale prisoners' dilemmas and getting the other army into it. And my standard sort of story for this, which I sometimes use in explaining the conflict between individual rationality and group rationality, is that you're one of a line of several, it's 1,000 years ago, and you're one of a line of several thousand men with spears pointed that way. And why are your spears pointed that way? Because coming at you are a few thousand men on horseback and their lances are pointing at you. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if all of us stand and plant our spears, with luck we can break their charge. And if we break their charge, some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do. I should stand. I'm sorry I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. If everybody else stands and I run, there are thousands of them, my running will have a very small effect on the chance of breaking the charge, but I won't be one of the ones who dies. If everyone else runs and I stand, I'm dead. Whatever they are doing, just like Christian Lemon, I should run. We all run and most of us die. Alright? And I suspect that if you think about what really, if you look new enough about what really happened in historical battles, a lot of it is like that. A lot of it is that the good general puts an enemy unit in a situation where everybody makes that calculation. The unit runs away, he doesn't have to fight them, he goes fight somebody else. And the good general figures out ways of keeping his unit from being in that situation that it doesn't. And one of the solutions is proverbial. It's called burning your bridges behind you. That if you can arrange it so your troops can escape, it's very dangerous. If you lose, you may all die, but they won't run away. I like to argue that in the American Revolution, we make fun of the British Army for having formations and uniform with buttons and stuff like that. This is the same British Army that a few decades later beat the greatest general in the world at Waterloo. I think they knew what they were doing. And that what's going on is the reason you march your troop in rigid formations is it makes it real hard to run away without being obvious. And if your men have bright red uniforms with lots of buttons, changing to a civilian in a blink of an eye is real hard to do. So I think that part of what they were doing really was based on that kind of calculation. There was a 19th century military historians, theorists, one of them is called a man called Dupuy, who tried to reconstruct battles and figure out what had really happened. And one of their views was that the standard story of a column of cavalry charging a line of infantry and running into it doesn't happen. That what usually happens is that at some magic point, either the column figures out that the line's not going to run and stops charging, or the line figures out the column isn't going to stop and runs. And he goes through other cases. But those are all cases where you're using prisoner's dilemma essentially as a tool for avoiding the several of these arguments with regard to prisoner's dilemma and subgame perfect equilibrium and bilateral monopoly suggest the importance of doing strategies, ways of tying your hands so that I make decisions now, which keep me from making decisions later, that later I want to do, but now I want not to do, as it were. One other thing suggested by the bilateral monopoly analysis is that bilateral monopoly bargains with a large bargaining range, with a big surplus, with an apple that's worth $1 million to you and nothing to me, are likely to be very costly in the sense that it's worth both of us taking risks, spending resources, hiring lawyers, doing things in order to make sure we get more of that gain. And if you think about real legal issues, the question, for example, of damages versus injunction. If you imagine the case where my noisy factory or leaking chemical factory or something is imposing costs on you, and the court agrees that you're in the right and I'm in the wrong. And the question is, should the law let you insist on an injunction making me stop it, or should it only allow you to sue for damages? in the case where the damages to you are probably very small compared to the cost to me of solving them, if you have an injunction which set up a bilateral monopoly market with a huge range, all right, it's going to cost me $1 million to shut down my chemical factory. There's no way I can keep it from causing a problem otherwise. It costs you only $10,000 to move your house or the inconvenience of itching from my chemicals or whatever the cost is. Therefore, you would accept any offer from me above $10,000. I would accept any demand from you below $1 million. We could spend a lot of resources bargaining over that. Therefore, that's much to be said for making a damage payment. In the case where the two costs are close to equal, on the other hand, damage payment may give us the wrong answer. If the court does a bad job of estimating where it's bargaining, I'm not going to accept more. I'm not going to agree to pay you more than saves me to be able to. So that's another lesson, and that gives us something of a handle on transaction costs, a little bit more than we use. So I think those cover the things I wanted to say, and
see you in 2 days.